This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hi, this is Katie reading from Southern Living Magazine. We're on the October issue of 2024. And starting with the letter from the editor. This is entitled, A Great Read. If you're looking for a fall page-turner, I've got one for you. There's nothing better than discovering a book you love, the kind you walk around thinking about all the time. I wish that happened to me more often, but once or twice a year, I'll find one so engrossing it even keeps me, thankfully, away from my phone. In a perfect world, I'd have uninterrupted hours to sit with it on a porch, but with a busy job, two kids, two dogs, and seven chickens, that just doesn't happen. I steal away every minute I can to get in a few pages, almost always to the detriment of an endless to-do list. Not long ago, I came across a book like this in Fawn Weaver's Love and Whiskey, the remarkable true story of Jack Daniel, his master distiller Nearest Green, and the improbable rise of Uncle Nearest. It recounts the incredible tale of a formerly enslaved man, Nathan Nearest Green, who taught a young Jack Daniel the complicated process of making Tennessee whiskey. He developed a lifelong friendship with Daniel and later became the first master distiller of the storied brand, leaving behind an extraordinary legacy. Their families have stayed connected for generations, and, of course, Jack Daniel's whiskey went on to become one of the most profitable and recognizable spirits on the planet. I was delighted when Weaver, who was on a book tour, stopped by the Southern Living offices to record an episode of Biscuits and Jam. That's our podcast about food, music, and Southern culture. It's a conversation that stayed with me in the same way her book did. A born storyteller with a contagious laugh, Weaver seemed to be just as excited talking about Nearest Green now as she was in 2016 when she started doing her research. Originally from California, she became so obsessed with Green's narrative that she purchased the farm where he and Daniel got their start in Lynchburg, Tennessee. Today, Weaver and her husband, Keith, have their own whiskey brand, Uncle Nearest, that has won more than 1,000 industry awards, a foundation that offers a college scholarship to Green's descendants and a 458-acre distillery outside Shelbyville that features the world's longest bar. Whether or not you enjoy drinking whiskey, this is a great read that unfolds like a mystery. Weaver spent years talking to family members, hosting community events, and digging through archives to paint a picture of a man who had been lost to history. I won't spoil the rest of it for you, but if her goal was to make sure no one ever forgets the legacy of Nearest Green, she certainly succeeded. Now, if anyone can recommend another book to get me through the fall, that's by Sid Evans, editor-in-chief of Southern Living Magazine. Some other books, cookbooks, which are hot off the shelf. These three new Southern cookbooks are worth their salt. The first is Baking in the American South, 200 recipes and their untold stories, by Anne Byrne. The next is American Grill, 125 Recipes for Mastering Live Fire, by Tyler Florence. And the third is Southern Get-Togethers, a Guide to Hosting Unforgettable Gatherings, by Kelsey Bernard Clark. In the next section of the magazine, called In Season, we're loving, sharing, and celebrating. The new pumpkin palette, trade the standard jack-o'-lantern hue for a wide spectrum of shades, from deep green to blush pink. The front door shown is steps leading up to a door with lots and lots of pumpkins and gourds. The description of it is moody welcome. Call on grays, dark greens, and purples for a subtly spooky front porch. Miller began with an assortment of large heirloom pumpkins in gray and white, placing them down the stairs in an asymmetrical fashion. The party pro then filled in the gaps with deep green gourds, as well as green and white variegated ones. I love the way the darker green helps the others to pop and creates some dimension and depth, she notes. Miller also included a few containers which she filled with plants like Mexican sage, ornamental kale, and violas for sturdy pops of purple that will look good well into the winter. It's a fabulous and unexpected color for this time of year, she says of the choice. Another picture shows tabletop gems. Jewel tone linens and ceramics lend punchy contrast. A zippy autumn arrangement relies on lemony yellows and citrusy greens. The Birmingham florist Buffy Hargett Miller anchored her dining room display on one end with three clay pots of varying sizes in which she planted coleus and fall lettuces. From there, she kept a low profile. You want to use things that are under 12 inches so people can see over them and talk, she advises. Miller selected yellow and yellow-green vines from her local garden center to position down the table, layering in lettuce leaves and berries for additional color. Because the gourds aren't cut or pierced, they should last from early October through Thanksgiving. And another picture shows a blushing trio. Peachy pink pumpkins bring softness to this living room vignette. For a smart swap, use faux gourds for seasonal decor that'll last forever. Creating odd-numbered groupings is the key to this coffee table-worthy look, says Miller, who chose coral-colored pumpkins in different shapes for its foundation. She then used hot glue to secure materials like dried flowers, feathers, mushrooms, reindeer moss, pine cones, and pods to their tops. All of these can be found at a wholesale florist or a craft shop. They add great texture, she says, of the organic elements. One tip from the expert: place the taller, larger details close to the stems and work out from there, finishing with more dried vines around the base. The next article is called Perfect Pairs: Two Savory Ways to Enjoy These Autumn Gems. One shows a pizza, which is a pear, bacon, and gorgonzola flatbread, and the other is a tender crisp skillet full of apples and pork chops. Here are the recipes. Skillet pork chops with caramelized pears. This serves four. Sprinkle four 1 1/4 inch thick bone-in center-cut pork chops evenly with 1 1/2 teaspoon each kosher salt, black pepper, and ground fennel seeds. Let's stand for 30 minutes. Heat 2 tablespoons olive oil in a 12-inch cast-iron skillet over medium-high heat. Add the pork, cook until golden brown, 3 to 5 minutes per side. Transfer to a plate. Do not wipe the skillet clean. Add 3 cups, 1-inch thick, pear wedges from 3 medium-sized green Anjou pears. Reduce the heat to medium. Cook, turning occasionally until pears are caramelized, about 6 minutes. Stir in 1/3 cup chicken stock, 2 tablespoons each maple syrup and apple cider vinegar, 2 teaspoons stone ground mustard, and 4 thyme sprigs. Nestle the pork chops into the skillet, simmer until an instant read thermometer inserted into the thickest portion of the meat registers 140 degrees Fahrenheit. Transfer the pork to a clean plate. Cook sauce until slightly thickened and pears are just softened, 2 to 3 minutes. Return the pork to the skillet and spoon the sauce over the pork. Season with additional salt to taste and garnish with fresh thyme leaves. For the pear, bacon, and gorgonzola flatbread, preheat the oven to 450 degrees. Toss together 1 cup thinly sliced pear from 1 medium-sized red Anjou pear and 2 teaspoons lemon juice in a small bowl. Place 1 16¼ by 4½-inch flatbread on a large parchment paper-lined baking sheet. Sprinkle with 1 cup shredded Fontina cheese. Top with pear and 1/3 cup sliced shallot. Bake until cheese is melted, 12 to 15 minutes. Remove from the oven and sprinkle with 1/3 cup crumbled gorgonzola cheese, 1/4 teaspoon flaky sea salt, and 1/8 teaspoon black pepper. Drizzle with 1 tablespoon of honey and top with 1/2 cup of loosely packed baby arugula and 2 tablespoons cooked crumbled bacon from 2 slices. Slice and serve immediately. And the next article is entitled A Butterfly Haven. In the Texas Hill Country, a conservationist is helping monarchs adjust to the changing world. 24 years ago, Monica Makel bought a small property on the Llano River in central Texas as an escape from fast-paced San Antonio. A journalist and marketing professional by trade, she didn't at first realize the value of the location on which she and her husband would later build their ranch. She also had no idea how this decision would eventually transform her life. One October evening, a few years later, a friend invited Makel to their nearby house, which sat on a watershed with several large cypresses. All these butterflies dropped from the sky and started to gravitate toward the trees, she recalls. Stronger people who could swing a big 12-foot-long pole began trying to capture them, and we waited. By the end of the evening, we'd tagged 200 butterflies, and I left there enchanted. Makel recognized some of the potential geographic similarities between her ranch and her friends, and wondered if her waterside land might also provide a stop on the Texas Funnel, a wide flyway that monarchs follow as they wing south from Canada and the northern U.S. states. The rugged groups of these black and orange insects take off in late summer and early fall, following this path of up to 2,800 miles that will ultimately lead them to the forest colonies in Mexico. The journey is a treacherous one, with many butterflies never arriving at their intended destination. Still, these majestic creatures flit and float their way through it every year, and then fly back come spring. The butterflies had, in fact, been around Makel's home the whole time, but she had never noticed them before. We went kayaking at our usual spots along a grove of pecan trees. I looked up and the butterflies erupted, she recalls. That night, she tagged 50 of them. Makel went on to launch Texas Butterfly Ranch, her attempt to raise awareness about monarchs, encourage conservation efforts, and have conversations with fellow advocates to track, study, and ultimately help these butterflies survive the shifting sands of their environment. Last fall, however, researchers recorded the second smallest roost since measurements started in 1993. Masses of these tiny animals covered just 2.2 acres of the monarch butterfly biosphere in Michoacán, Mexico, a 59% decrease over the previous year's low number and only slightly above the 1.7 acres from the 2013 season. This downward trend is nothing new for those who carefully monitor the annual voyages. But Makel, whose book, The Monarch Butterfly Migration, was released in August, argues that insect populations are quite volatile, bouncy even. Some years are better than others, but in the more than three decades of data, the numbers have been on a steady decline. The effects of climate change has had tremendous implications for butterfly populations as monarchs lay their eggs exclusively on milkweed plants. Droughts, floods, and other extreme weather conditions have destroyed these roosting and breeding grounds. Use of herbicides has had similar impacts, and forest destruction in Mexico is shrinking the size of their wintering sites. All of this bad news drowns out some of the good. Scientists in South Carolina have identified a group of monarchs that live year-round in the state's swamps and sea islands. These butterflies, like the ones in Texas, rely on native species of milkweed plants, but they don't leave their migration. Their migration spans a relatively small area in comparison to the transcontinental trek of their peers. In California, there were only a couple thousand monarchs recorded in 2020. But the most recent data shows a dramatic increase to about 330,000. Those stories, Makel notes, offer reason for hope. After nearly two decades of research and observation since her first sighting of these cypress trees, she firmly believes that these insects are changing and evolving, but not disappearing. Whatever this next chapter holds for monarchs, they're going to be around. They will still be with us, Makel says. They're just morphing to the next stage. Next is an article entitled Forging a Legacy. A Fredericksburg, Texas couple is creating a new class of heirloom cast iron cookware. When Jay Mallinckrodt pitched the idea of crafting cast iron cookware to his wife and business partner Heather in 2020, she was hesitant. "I immediately said no," she recalls with a laugh. "But I finally agreed as long as we made something that we would actually want to use ourselves." Like many others during the initial throes of the pandemic, their multi-generational family operation, Heartland Enterprises, which specializes in machining parts for jet engines and gas and oil equipment, was seeing a lull. "No one was flying, no one was drilling," says Jay, "so we had time to try something different." Unsatisfied with the modern cast iron and nonstick skillets on the market, the Mallinckrodts sought to create a piece that was easy to use and, above all, meant to last. "There's such nostalgia around cast iron, and everyone we meet seems to have fond stories of their grandmother's old skillet," says Heather. "We thought, surely there are folks wanting to start their own legacy." Fortunately, Heartland Enterprises facilities were already equipped with the proper machinery and trained professionals to get the job done, and for the casting, the couple had a pre-existing relationship with a foundry in nearby Corsicana. After designing a prototype and perfecting a 10-step process that includes multiple rounds of seasoning, all done by hand, Fredericksburg Cast Iron Company released its first product, a classic 10.5-inch skillet that boasts a buttery smooth cooking surface. Their first limited launch sold out in just 7 minutes, and then the following batches went out of stock even faster. The Mallinckrodts want to prove that a good cast iron skillet isn't easy to ruin, despite a finicky reputation. Every one of our family members has tried their best to destroy it, and not always intentionally, says Heather. From burnt gumbo roux to a melted spoon, there hasn't been anything that couldn't be fixed. That's the beautiful thing about cast iron cooking at home. In addition to their signature number 10 skillet, Fredericksburg Cast Iron Company has introduced flat-surfaced comals, which can be used on everything from the stove or grill to a fire pit, as well as petite ramekins and smash burger press. A Dutch oven is also in the works, set to come out next year. The line is available at local retailers like Black Chalk, Home, and Laundry, but a significant portion of sales comes from out-of-state customers via the brand's online shop, fbgcastiron.com. Despite these achievements, the Mallinckrodts' ultimate measure of success is rooted in creating a long-lasting legacy for themselves and others. You're not going to have to throw this skillet away. You're going to be able to hand it down to your kids, says Jay. Take a little bit of care of it, and it'll perform for generations. Here's a cast iron tip sheet. Keep your skillet in top-notch shape for years to come. Grab the salt. Pesky food bits clinging to the bottom of your pan? Use coarse ground salt to buff them off gently. Bust the rust. Fixing this is easy with a bit of light scrubbing or just a few minutes of soaking in the solution of equal parts water and vinegar. If all else fails, a few drops of lye-free dish soap won't hurt your pan. Rinse and dry it well. Bring on the fat. When seasoning cast iron pieces, go for neutral oils with high smoke points, such as vegetable, canola, or grapeseed. Apply a light sheen over the entire surface and bake in the oven for 1 hour. And next is the Dear Grumpy article by Steve Bender. This is the question and answer article about gardening. The first question. I've heard there's a movement in England to let tree leaves lie where they fell all winter because they provide shelter for beneficial insects. Should we in the States follow their lead and put away our rakes until spring? The answer. Never do anything they do in England. Bake beans for breakfast. Drive on the left. Take part in World Naked Gardening Day. No way. Well, maybe except for that last one. Environmentalists contend that leaves on your lawn protect pollinators like butterflies from the cold. But thick mats of moldy foliage also harbor critters you don't want, like ticks, stink bugs, cockroaches, aphids, and voles, and aren't good for the grass. Grumpy makes quick work of leaves on his lawn using a mulching mower to chop them into bits that feed the soil. Yeah, that does take out a couple of moths, but about a million leaves in my wooded backyard do plenty to compensate the wildlife. In fact, yesterday I discovered an 18-foot Burmese python back there that looked like good eating. Upon preparing it, I found an adult coyote in there, and in the coyote were 8 squirrels. That snake was nature's nesting doll, and it's all because I left the leaves. The next question, I live in Texas and have been growing blackberries for 3 years. The harvest was good this season. Now what? Should I cut back the old canes? If so, can I root them? Blackberry bushes typically bear fruit on two-year-old canes that die at the end of that season. After harvest, cut these old canes to the ground and throw them away. No, they're not good for rooting. The remaining canes will fruit next year, and new ones will grow to provide berries the following year. Next question, how can I get rid of those awful smilax vines? Answer, for those who don't know, the genus smilax includes a host of native vines that feature horribly thorny stems. This accounts for such gleeful common names as catbriar, greenbriar, bullbriar, horsebriar, and sawbriar. Because they grow from huge tubers and rhizomes, killing them with an herbicide is nearly impossible. If you spray them, the foliage turns brown and drops. 2 weeks later, new stems and leaves emerge to plague you. The only sure solution that I know is digging them up by the roots. Mature vines may require a backhoe for this, so let's hope two burly guys with shovels will suffice in your case. The next question, I live in South Central Virginia and have 3 healthy encore azaleas that never bloom. They get filtered morning sun and a bit of afternoon light as well. The answer, encore azaleas that flower in spring and fall bloom better with lots of light, even full sun. Perhaps your plants aren't getting enough. Try moving them to a brighter spot this fall. Also, next spring, give them some fertilizer for acid-loving plants, such as Espoma holly tone. The next question, rabbits are mowing down my plants and eating things I'm told they don't like. I've put cages out to protect my garden, but that detracts from the aesthetics. How does Holland grow all those tulips? Don't they have rabbits? Grumpy's answer, I hear that wild rabbits are relatively scarce in the Netherlands. Maybe the varmints get chopped up by windmills. If you don't have the space or resources for one of those at your home, try spraying your plants with a repellent, such as Liquid Fence, Deer and Rabbit, or Bobex R. And the last question, why did my peach and plum trees die in the middle of summer? They got watered, but not a lot. There's no rot. The peach is dead and the plum is growing back from the roots. What happened? I live in southern Arizona. The answer, maybe they had tickets for a Taylor Swift concert. She canceled and they couldn't bear it. Perhaps when it was 115 degrees at night, they didn't get quite enough water. In any case, both are generally short-lived trees due to their susceptibility to a slew of insects and diseases. That's all for today. This is Katie reading from Southern Living Magazine.